Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. Our special law or weird law from around the world today comes courtesy of a place called Delaware in the United States. In Delaware, pawnbrokers, that is those individuals that buy and sell used goods at a premium, often very unattractive to you as the consumer or the borrower, are specifically prohibited from accepting artificial limbs or wheelchairs as pledges in the city or in the state of Delaware under the Delaware Code Title 24. What a bizarre law. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at Kumba results, their full year results for the year ended December. We're going to speak to the Kumba CEO around that. We're going to catch up with the Chief Financial Officer at DRD Gold around their half year results. And then we're going to do some budget expectations. The budget speech is up tomorrow. We're going to be getting some thoughts around what we could expect to hear. We're going to be speaking to Chief Economist at Investec, Annabelle Bishop, as well as a tax specialist from Forvis Mazars around some tax expectations. There's been a lot of rumors around whether or not we're going to get VAT increases, pay-as-you-earn increases, wealth taxes, and all sorts of other things there. So I thought we'd take a look at some expectations ahead of tomorrow's budget speech. Of course, we will be bringing you all of the blow-by-blow action of that budget speech once it has been delivered by the finance minister. We're going to be speaking to the Deputy Minister of Finance on tomorrow evening's show as well, so tune in for that. But we're going to be doing the budget build-ups today and preparing for tomorrow's big speech. And then we're going to wrap up the show as we do on a Tuesday with a property segment. We're going to be speaking to the founder and CEO at Arrivo Property around the property boom we're seeing in the Western Cape at the moment.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
For starters, markets have been moving throughout the day, and we're going to get a sense of what they've been up to. I'm joined on the line by wealth manager at PSG Wealth, Skulk Lowe, to take a look at some of the market movements. Good evening, Skulk. Lovely to catch up with you as always. I thought this time of the year would be below 18 Rand. We are not. We're closer to 18 Rand 50, and I want to know why.
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to all the MoneyWeb listeners. Yeah, good question. I would say wouldn't be reading too much into the rand weakness. We know the dollar has really been improving, of late. So that could be one of the reasons. We've seen some movement in the commodities. So you're 100% right. I would have thought, if you look at some of these commodity movements, and I did something today where I looked at some of these commodity movements. And I don't know if you've looked at this, Jimmy, but and the data, I've actually run it until 2 days ago. And this is all in rand. And this is just movement for this year alone. So starting from the top, top performer, and you better get that fix, and you better get it quick, Jimmy, because as we sit here, coffee is 28% higher than what it was end of 2024. And then we can go on soya beans and, lean hogs. I don't even know what a lean hog is. We're talking about 11%. Lumber, at 9%. Gold, we know the gold. Gold, 7, 8, 9%. Copper, 7%, silver, 6%, platinum, 6%. So this is big movers. And usually this, when we read things like palladium up 6%, platinum up, also over 6%, gold up, those type of levels, that, is good for South Africa. South Africa is one of the largest producers of these commodities. Also, some of the softer commodities, we large producers. So Maybe it's a lagged effect. Maybe the international investors are a little bit worried. We know we've had some political unrest over the past few weeks. We've seen, today we've seen the unemployment data came out. And I know you're going to chat to Annabelle a little bit later. But this is things I want to, when I listen to the budget tomorrow, I want to see them seriously address this. Because we'd be talking about, somewhat better, but still, to go from 32.1% to 31.9%, and this is the official unemployment rate. When you look at the expanded unemployment rate. That's the one that's actually, to me, it's more important. And for the listeners out there that don't know what the expanded employment rate is, that's which includes people that's pretty much discouraged. They're not even looking for work anymore because they know they're not going to find a work. The expanded unemployment rate is currently at 41.9%. So yeah, I'm a little bit worried. Those factors definitely could definitely eat into these movements on the rand. Remember, the rand is usually a share price, so to speak, for your country. As your country or your company improves, your share price improve, and we would like to see, you know, our country really improve before we're going to start seeing the currency improve.
It's definitely a reflection of the country and the way that the world sees the country. Skalk, I want to get your thoughts around some of the developments that we are seeing from a global perspective. You mentioned, of course, that we are seeing a lot of political tensions and global tensions as well. It doesn't seem to be deterring some of the markets. Commodities are running, as you said, but we are generally seeing that equity markets are on the up. If we look at local equity markets and we just look at the top 40 in general, top 40 is at all-time highs at the moment. It is up about 6%, I think, for the month of February, and it is at all-time highs above 81,000 points there. Is this something that could continue going into the rest of the year? I mean, I don't see a lot of volatility that hasn't already been baked into the markets. Obviously, the recent sentiments by some members in the US to have South Africa removed from AGOA are something that could potentially weigh in on markets. But how are you seeing just where we are? All-time highs locally, other international indices also at all-time highs or nearing all-time highs as well?
It's definitely in the market. There's a bit of a reversion back to value play. And I've often been talking about South Africa as a value play. But it's not only South Africa. I mean, we know that Europe has been seen as lagging. The Western counterparts. When you look at it, the same data that I've just given you, that the year-to-date performances, the S&P 500 is now struggling to keep itself in the green for 2025, and the NASDAQ only just positive. Over that same period, the JSE, you know, has grown by close to 8% in rand terms. When you look at the euro stocks, that is up over 10% year to date. The DAX, that's the German DAX, that is up over 10%. So that is giving you an idea where the smart money is flowing. And this is not sort of unexpected. When we went into 2005, I think all this, the sort of the big investment houses, they were calling and saying, well, yes, we buy into this AI euphoria. We buy into Trump 2.0. We buy into all these things, but just remember, you know, most of the time, share prices don't reflect what we're currently seeing. It's reflecting what we're going to see. And we already knew that President Trump is going to be leading the US. We already know that AI is going to pretty much take over the world. And that is why, you know, some of these indexes, most specific, the US indexes, are trading at elevated levels. I'm a little bit worried about that. So I think you're asking me for 2025, for the remainder of the year. I think I do still see a lot of opportunity. I think what we're seeing in the commodity market is not necessarily something that I think is going to outplay itself in the next day or two. I think there's still some room, upside room. And that could be good for South Africa. That could be good for our currency. That could be good for our current account. We need to take advantage out of this because then it'll be good for our companies in South Africa as well.
Well, the last commodity cycle ran for a couple of months, I think just about a year as well. So we'll have to keep an eye on that and see how that continues to unfold. For now, we'll leave the conversation there, Skalk. Thanks as always for the time and for the insights. Lovely to catch up. Skalk Lowe, Wealth Manager at PSG Wealth, joining us to take a look at some market movements as well as what could potentially be unfolding for the rest of the year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We are reflecting on some results that came through this morning. We got some SENS announcements from Kumba Iron Ore. They gave us their full year results for the year ended 31 December 2024. I'm joined on the line by the Kumba CEO, Mpumi Zikalala, to take a look at the company's performance and see what we make of it. Good evening, Mpumi. Thanks so much for taking the time. Always lovely to catch up with you, especially around this time of the year. It looks as though the year was quite an interesting one from an operational perspective and from a performance perspective. How do you reflect on it as a team.
Yeah, Jimmy, thank you for having us. So, I mean, when I spoke about the results earlier, I said that it was a good set of results. And a couple of things to highlight. One is from a safety perspective, we saw a 22% improvement in our total recordable injury frequency rate. And this is the best ever performance for Kumba. And linked to that, we clearly had a fatality-free year. From a production perspective, production was flat. And that essentially reflected where the logistics performance was. And we planned clearly for this, understanding where the challenges that we've got in the space. But more so, when we spoke again, we spoke about the fact that we saw a 4.4 billion rand improvement in our cost base. When we started the year, we spoke about the fact that we were reconfiguring our business for the lower production performance. And we spoke about the fact that we wanted to get to a 2.5 to 3 billion rand improvement on our cost base. So we actually beat that by 47%, and it's credit to all the wonderful men and women at Kumba, because that allowed us to improve our C1 unit cost from $41 per ton to $39 per ton. And then clearly, if one looks at the bottom line, we delivered an attributable free cash flow of 14.5 billion rand, and that allowed our board to declare a final dividend of 19.90 rand per share for the half, and for the full year, 38.67 rand. And that was actually for the full year, 100% payout ratio on our headline earnings. So all in all, a good year. But I have to say, we had our various challenges. So there's a lot of work that was done to get to the space.
We'll get into some of those challenges in a second, Bumi. I want to just touch on the cost containment conversation. I mean, obviously, you touched on the fact that you were able to achieve that 4.4 billion rand in savings, but this is obviously in line with what you had guided for from that lower production. Take me through to the importance of cost containment in a cyclical environment like Kumba's, where sometimes there's a market slowdown, there's a demand side slowdown, and you still have to keep operating. There's nothing that says to your operations, hey, you guys can take a bit of a break. You can't continue to produce. Take me through how important that cost containment was for you in this year.
It was absolutely key, Jimmy. And for us, it was driven by a couple of factors. So firstly, our business is set up to actually sell over 40 million tons of iron ore. But as a result of the challenges that we've had in the logistics space, we've been sort of constrained from a sales perspective. And we fundamentally decided to just review our mine plan and optimize that, because we initially we kept, you know, producing, but we weren't selling, and we ended up with significant levels of stock, and we had to then face the reality and replan. And then linked to that, we reconfigured our entire business on the basis of the optimized mine plan, and we had to fundamentally drive for those cost efficiencies in order to improve our cost base. So it's been a lot of hard work that's gone in, properly planned and clearly delivered 47% more than what we initially planned for. And we will continue with this work, because particularly in a cyclical environment, we've spoken about it. Typically, people will talk about the prices, but in our space, we had additional challenges. And that's why we'll continue working on the cost base. So for this year, 2025, we've set ourselves yet another target of improving our cost base by 2.5 to 3 billion rands. And knowing my teams at Kumba, and it's a wonderful team, we will work very, very hard to achieve this.
Bumi, I want to look at the results that are bearing fruit in this current year. I mean, that cost containment alongside that export price holding ever so slightly to the green meant that you were able to protect that margin. And margins are very critical when you've got such a huge operational cost in running both sites and all the other operations that go into mining. I mean, take me through that margin protection and hitting that 41% EBITDA margin. That's obviously something you want to keep around that level.
Definitely. So Tim, if you look at it, I mean, our revenue actually reduced by 21%, and that was largely due to two factors. One was the pricing environment, but even within the pricing environment, we always compare our final price relative to the benchmark price, and that was actually better than the benchmark price. And it's simply because at Kumba, we focus fundamentally on the delivery of high quality iron ore, and clearly that ends us the premiums that we rely on as a business. So that work continued. And going forward, we will actually be investing additional capital to further improve on this. It's a circa 11.2 billion rand technology project that will be the implementation of the ultra-high dense medium separation technology at our Sishen mine. So that's the one thing that we focused on. But in addition to that, we've spoken about costs. We've understood that when one looks at the challenges that we have, particularly with regards to the reduced sales volumes, which is needed to focus on the things that we can control in order to ultimately do exactly what you've said, which is for us to protect our margins. And that's our game, hey? So we figured that there's a lot of uncertainty in both the macro and the micro space. We need to influence the spaces that we can influence, and that's through us working with Transnet and our government around the turnaround of Transnet, but more so within the space that we can control, which is the cost space. We understood that there's a lot that we can do.
Mbumi, from an outlook perspective, take me through how you are seeing the markets. I mean, you touched on obviously being able to control the controllables that sit within your wheelhouse, but things like exporting into China, which is such a big part of your export strategy, and the logistics side of it from a Transnet perspective, take me through how the business is looking at those two factors going into 2025, saying that those are both out of our control, but we might be able to just prepare for an upside on both sides.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, I mean, if you look at us as a business, I spoke about the fact that we focus predominantly on the delivery of high-quality iron ore, and we are investing in the space to further improve on this going forward. What that allows us to do is to actually to sell, yes, into China, but to sell into other markets as well. And that includes Europe, Japan, and South Korea. And as a result, if you think about it, those are countries that primarily focus on decarbonization. And as a result, we get to earn a higher premium when we sell into those regions. And that's something that we fundamentally focused on. And we see that essentially continuing going forward. If we look at prices for this year, we expect them to remain predominantly at current levels. But when we look at the longer term from an iron ore industry perspective, and fundamentally linking that back to steel, we are very bullish when it comes to steel, particularly steel that's produced within the aspects of reducing the carbon emissions that come from the entire steelmaking process. And we fundamentally look at this. We say that the global GDP is going to increase going forward, and that requires steel. We also look at the fact that the world will have to decarbonize going forward, and that will essentially require steel. And fundamentally within that, we look at the fact that with especially decarbonization, people will have to utilize higher quality iron ore in order to reduce their carbon emissions. And that's a space that we are planning to continue focusing on. So when I look at the ultra-high dense medium separation project, it will certainly help us with regards to the improvements in our product quality. And that's something that will benefit us in the longer term. The other aspect that we clearly consider on the cost-based side is the fact that from a technology perspective, the investment will allow us to actually treat, believe it or not, lower run-of-mine material, but still deliver higher quality iron ore. And with the treatment of the lower run-of-mine material, it means that we'll be able to take material that's used to go into the waste stream and treat that and actually recover higher quality iron ore. And that will allow us to further improve our cost base. And we clearly focus a lot on our cost competitiveness. So net, there's a lot of work that's going into our space right now, not just looking at making sure that we protect our margins in the short to medium term, but also looking at us positioning ourselves for the future. Mm. The last thing around this is that this technology will actually allow us to extend the life of mine of Sishen Mine. We saw that. With this round, we're able to extend the life of mine by 2 years, but we do know that we've got additional life of mine extension optionality that could possibly take us to 2044.
Mbumi, before I let you go, I want to take a quick look at the share price performance. 47% down year on year. Obviously, this is one of those not controllables that doesn't sit in your wheelhouse to be able to determine. And the job of the business and the job of the board is to operate as efficiently as possible, which you've done. Would you say that the market has potentially been a little harsh in terms of how they've responded to your operations, or is it just part of what happens in the markets and that's why you focus on the things that you can control?
So if you look at our share price performance, I mean, the bulk of this has been driven by the changes that we've seen in the iron ore prices. If one looks at where we opened at the beginning of last year and where we ended. And clearly, as a business, we predominantly focus on iron ore. So we've essentially felt that hitting us hard on the share price. And there are a couple of additional factors, but that's the bulk of it. Clearly, as the CEO of Kumba, if you ask me, I do believe that our share price should be stronger and we'll continue working on the things that we can control, Jimmy. I think for me, the biggest thing that we focused on as a team is that we can always talk about the macro and the micro dynamics and talk about all the challenges. But what matters the most is us then looking internally and saying, how do we still position ourselves for success, even within those dynamics? And that's why we focused on the cost base, because we wanted to improve our position on the cost curve. And that will then allow us to continue ensuring that our business is sustainable and through future investments, that actually gives us future life of mine extension. So clearly, we're focusing, I have to say, on the things that we can control. I think we did that exceptionally well in 2024, but we'll continue doing that because we do believe that there's more value that we can still drive for.
A clearly focused business and a very focused team. They're delivering where they absolutely can and where they need to, and it's showing on the balance sheet. Hopefully the market starts to respond to that accordingly, but we'll leave the conversation there for now. Mpumi, thanks so much for those insights. Mpumi Zikalala, CEO of Kumba Iron Ore, on their full year's numbers for the year ended 31 December 2024.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We keep the conversation going with our mining updates, and we're taking a look at interim results from DRD Gold. They gave us the first half of the year ended at December 2024. I'm joined on the line by the company's chief financial officer, Riaan Davel, to take a look at the numbers and see how we can make sense of them. Good evening, Riaan. Thanks so much for taking the time. Good, strong start to the first half of the year. It's always nice to have a gold price that's playing ball. How are you guys feeling going into the second half of the year?
Thanks, Jimmy. Nice chatting with you. Yes, gold price always helps at this level, but underlying operational performance is what really gets us going. And it was one of those six-month periods where things turned out as we wanted it to, as we when we talked to the market in August in 2024. So what we said we wanted to do specifically for Ergo, so we wanted its volumes up, and we wanted to look at costs, and we managed to do that. So period on period, just 5% up for Ergo, obviously, and that's with a volume increase of 22%. Obviously helped by our PV and battery system, so that helped, and then the change in material, as we said we wanted to do. So it's more slimes material, obviously decreasing machine hire costs, so all of that helps. And then electricity up only 3%, with volume up 22%, and looking at double-digit increases for Eskom. So really positive from Ergo, and the same on Far West, more consistency, tons coming through as designed, slight increase in yield. And obviously, we always underestimate that, Jimmy, but when costs are under control and the margin opens up with a high gold price that we're experiencing, all of that just flows through to our profit, which we see a bottom line and headline earnings up 65% period on period.
Riaan, the cost side of it, as you mentioned, keeping those costs under control is quite important. All-in sustained costs were up 6% in dollar terms. Obviously, part of that would have been owing to a slightly weaker rand at certain times and the average pricing moving around there. But 6% in the context of a gold price that's run as hard as it has doesn't really seem like much for concern at the moment. I suppose, as you said, it does give you a bit of room as well from a margin perspective when the gold price is running that far ahead and your costs are not growing by much more than inflation, really.
Exactly. And the all-in sustaining cost one you referred to, obviously sustaining costs for us decrease period on period. So we're very much focusing on growth capital expenditure for both operations. And then the other big factor, obviously, for all-in sustaining costs is the cash operating cost that I mentioned we really managed to keep under control, assisted by good investments like the PV, and hopefully we'll still see the full benefit of that down the line, and the battery. And then, as I've mentioned, that Far West, it's a different kind of operation. It's one site. It's got full production from the Driefontein 3 site now. But all of that helps. And as I said, flowing straight through, if you look at all-in sustaining cost margin for us is really, really healthy at 35% with the increase in gold price.
Rian, I want to take a look at something else on the balance sheet that's increased. That's your deferred tax liability, just north of R1 billion. It was just under R1 billion this time last year, so it's just north of R1 billion. But there were some acquisitions that were made there. Take me through some of those adjustments from an acquisition point of view that might have driven up some of those numbers, but also the importance of those acquisitions, I suppose.
Yes, then so. All the capex that we're incurring, obviously at Ergo, just under R3 billion over the last 2 to 3 years for the solar and battery project, and then similar capex projects, not of the same size, but over time for Far West. So both those capex numbers mean that we can utilize those capital deductions for paying less current tax or even no current tax at the moment. But you're quite right. What that does is it depletes the tax base from an accounting point of view. And that's right, that deferred tax liability, what it indicates on the balance sheet is in the future, if we continue to make profits, at some point there'll be a profit, let's call it a taxable profit then at that point, that you cannot deduct any allowance, like a capital allowance for any more. So it almost warns in the future that there may be more tax. Which is down the line, obviously great for investment and great for SARS eventually, if all of these investments pay off and we're able to generate taxable income over a long time. So that will be a feature of our accounts in this highly capital period, where current tax will be low and even nothing for the operations, but deferred tax will continue to increase.
Rian, I want to look at something else that's increased in the interim period, and that is your interim dividend up 50%. Obviously, those benefits are something you can pass back to the shareholders, as you mentioned, is that you might be able to pass those back in the interim while you're building and while you're expanding and while you're growing the business. And it's always important to keep the shareholders in mind along the journey, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an important aspect for us, Jimmy. As you know, with this interim dividend, it's our 18th consecutive financial year that we'll be returning cash back to shareholders. So we would like to keep that track record going, although we are very clear to the market to say that we will prioritize cash that we generate towards this R10 billion capital expansion program of ours over the next 2 to 3 years. But in a period like this, where we had really good operating results, really good operating cash flows from our business, I think it really makes sense to say also to shareholders, here's a dividend, there's an interim dividend in this case. Although down the line, we'll continue to manage and prioritize our cash towards CapEx as we position for growth down the line.
Rian, take me through that. Take me through the operational side of the business looking ahead. Obviously, production-wise, I want to get a sense of what you guys have in mind for the second half of the year, some of those CapEx commitments, or at least the capital plans or projections for the capital advancements. I mean, it's always nice to have a good liquidity position, just shy of R2 billion in liquidity that's sitting there, no bank debt sitting on the balance sheet. Those are very, very good things to have in place, but it just means that the business is able to grow quicker and stronger.
That's right, Vinny. And let me expand a little bit on that capital program of ours. It's part of our Vision 2028 that you would have maybe heard our CEO talk about. And it's in a vision for us to expand both our Ergo operations and our Far West Gold Recoveries operations. And it says it's a R10 billion capital program, and it's talked to Ergo firstly. We've already built the solar and the battery, just under R3 billion. And then it's a program to extend the Brakpan/Withok tailings facility to increase the tailings capacity for Ergo. And then at the Far West Gold Recovery side, we're looking to build and are currently building the regional tailings storage facility there, which is a magnificent facility, going to be able to take 800 million tons on the far west, and obviously with its related pipeline infrastructure. And we're also upgrading our plant there, the DP2 plant, from 600,000 tons a month to 1.2 million tons per month. So it's really something exciting to look forward to. And Vision 2028, what we're aiming for is at that time to have our tonnage throughput at 3 million tons per month. And then hopefully would have added approximately another ton of gold to our annual gold production. So up from the current around 5 tons, so hopefully 6 tons per annum gold production. And you're quite right, we don't have debt at the moment, but we have a facility that we put in place end of July in 2024 with Nedbank of up to 2 billion rand for 5 years to see us through this growth phase. And as I said, the benefit for us is still we continue to put out these operating results, and the gold price stays at high levels. We generate cash while we're building for Vision 2028 and setting up a business and hopefully be able to do that with minimum debt exposure. So for the rest of the year, hopefully more of the same, as I've mentioned, to optimize our solar and battery plant. And then we've kept our guidance the same. So we didn't change that in August 2024. So costs under control plus production. So it's for us to execute both from an operational level, but also from a growth capex point of view to support this Vision 2028 of ours.
Well, wish you the best of luck with those endeavors. We are certainly going to be keeping an eye on the progress that you continue to make. All the best for the second half of the year, and I'm sure we'll definitely catch up at the end of the year. We'll leave the conversation there for now. That was Riaan Davel, the Chief Financial Officer at DRD Gold, giving us an update on how they started the first half of their new financial year and what their plans look like for the second half.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love. Which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And ahead of tomorrow's big budget speech, we're going to be taking a look at some budget expectations for 2025. We're going to be speaking to two specialists around this and trying to get a bit of an understanding around where we could be, or what we could be in for, rather, come this time tomorrow. I'm joined on the line first by the chief economist at Investec, Annabel Bishop, to take a look at some of her expectations for the budget speech. Good evening, Annabel. Lovely to catch up with you as always. We seem to have these conversations on an annual basis, and every year we ask some of the same questions around what we expect to hear versus what we think we should, or what we expect to hear versus what we would like to hear. And I suppose this year is no different, but this is the first budget speech of the government of national unity, if that's what we're to call it. What are your expectations for them?
Yes, hi. So I think, you know, we continue to hope that we're going to get good news when we have a budget. And I suppose, you know, the best we can hope for is not to see any major tax increases. So we're not expecting to see any increase in VAT or income tax or corporate tax. That doesn't mean there won't be slight minor tax increases, you know, on alcohol, tobacco products, fuel, etc. And of course, those are all quite possible or probable. Of course, as well, they tend not to adjust for fiscal drag to raise more money. We can discuss that later. But listening to Edward Kieswetter today, you know, they really did indicate that they're hoping to actually improve SARS's collection and actually increase revenue that way, as opposed to see tax increases. So I suppose, you know, that's really what people are going to be mainly looking for in the budget tomorrow. But of course, as well, growth initiatives and, you know, items like whether the inflation target is adjusted, or, you know, what's coming through in terms of the grey listing, what deficiencies have we overcome.
Speaking of that fiscal drag that you touched on, Annabelle, I mean, obviously, when we look at things like the expenditure side of the budget, that's definitely somewhere where we're going to want to hear a lot more reforms come through, especially around things like spending less on bailing out SOEs, potentially not looking to have as many grants in the ecosystem, obviously trying to keep that expenditure side of it down, because it seems the deficit continues to grow. And unless we control that and we continue to contain that, it just creates a bigger problem down the road.
Well, that's exactly it. And when your deficit grows, your borrowing tends to have to grow as well. And in fact, you know, that's really the first things economists look at when they open the budget document. What is the borrowing to debt ratio? Has it increased? Is planned borrowing increasing? And of course, the same as you said, the budget deficit, the mismatch between expenditure and revenue. And of course, as you know, well pointed out, we can't keep spending when it doesn't meet our revenue. But South Africa has been doing that. So, you know, this is where we find ourselves in a difficult situation. We are aiming for a primary balance, and we have achieved one a while ago. Essentially, that means that our revenue expenditure matches. It's just the interest we pay on debt that's taking us over the edge. And that's why then debt is so important. If South Africa increases its borrowings, if it increases its debt costs, not only do future generations have to bear it, but also, of course, as well, it could risk a credit rating downgrade. And that obviously has implications for the rand, for the bond market. So these are all important metrics.
Annabelle, you bring up borrowing, and as you brought it up, you gave me chest pains, because I remembered that we are currently in the process of negotiating a 27 billion rand loan from the World Bank, and I'd love to get your thoughts around that, because as you said, it does impact future generations, but it also impacts what we have to repay from a borrowing perspective. Do you think that it's supposedly a development policy loan, do you think that is a good thing to be put to be going for at this time, or is it more around how we deploy the capital rather than what capital we go out and secure?
You don't get chest pains. It's not worth it. But secondly, you know, the thing about borrowing from the World Bank and, you know, from the multilaterals, you usually get very low rates of interest and favorable borrowing terms. And of course, as well, you know, these are aimed, as you said, at developmental objectives. And of course, these are vehicles that are available to developing countries. And we must, of course, bear in mind that South Africa is a developing country. It's not a developed economy. It's not a, you know, first world economy. And of course, making use of these cheap loans is quite worthwhile. It's quite normally done. As you said, quite rightly, however, it's an enormous amount of money. And, you know, we obviously do need to bear in mind that that money needs to be deployed, as you said, very carefully and appropriately to actually stimulate economic growth and, of course, for developmental objectives. But, you know, the risk, obviously, is that that is not necessarily always the case. And, of course, hence the concern. I think for South Africa, the real solution here, and we've obviously been talking about many factors so far, but economic growth. Economic growth is key, you know, and that's really what you need to drive faster government revenue to then work down your borrowings, not only repaying the debt, but obviously, you know, meeting your interest payments as well. And of course, obviously, reducing your fiscal deficit. So that's really the first prize, to get a strong economy, to get strong economic growth. And something that you mentioned, the GNU at the start, but the government of national unity, you know, is really aiming for, prior to the formation of the GNU, we had the business government collaboration, which is still operating. And the objectives they are to put in place improvements in infrastructure.
Well, we live in hope, and you and I are certainly going to catch up after the budget speech, because I want to see if that hope and optimism is something we can continue to hold on to. For now, we'll leave the conversation there. Thanks as always, Annabelle, for the time and for the insights. Annabelle Bishop, Chief Economist at Investec, taking a look at her budget expectations ahead of tomorrow's budget speech. We're going to go straight into the other conversation. We're going to be speaking to a partner for taxation at Forvis Mazars. That is Mike Touche. He joins me on the line now to give his thoughts around what we could be expecting here. Good evening, Mike. Thanks so much for taking the time. From a tax perspective, there's been a lot that's been swirling around in the media, swirling around on social media around what we could see from a budget speech. Things like VAT increases, a wealth tax being introduced. Annabelle Bishop just mentioned a sin tax adjustment, which we kind of have become accustomed to in previous budget speeches. What are your expectations from a tax perspective ahead of tomorrow's budget speech?
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to all your listeners. From a tax perspective, I think we're not really expecting any major changes. We don't expect any increases in tax rates or in VAT rates. I think where we will more likely feel some pain. I don't think we're going to get any relief for fiscal drag. So as inflation goes up and salaries get increased by that inflation rate, they do not adjust the tax brackets. And as a result, people are moved into the next higher tax bracket. Roughly, I suppose, about $20 billion is garnered out of that by the fiscus by not giving us that relief. Sin taxes, and fuel levy, I think they are going to be increasing. Treasury did put out a paper last year about increasing the taxes on alcohol and cigarettes. They haven't taken that discussion further, but it's maybe something on their radar screen. I think one has to be very careful about that because then it just drives the underground market maybe a little bit harder. So there's a fine balance there. There's been talk about extending the zero rating to some foodstuffs, especially chicken. What we've seen in the past, wherever revenue has given away something, they take it back somewhere else. A prime example was when we reduced our corporate tax rate from 28% to 27%. It was fine. They reduced the tax rate, but they limited the deductibility of your cess losses. So they do seem to tend to take back. So if we do have and I doubt it, I can't see them increasing that at all. So I don't think they'll deal with the zero rating of the foodstuffs, etc. Wealth tax, it was discussed by the Davis Committee, very complicated. We've got a thing called capital gains tax. It's been around with us for 23 odd years. It's still a complicated tax to deal with, a lot of nuances, etc. So something that might be difficult to implement. But the other thing is what we are seeing, for instance, in the UK. The UK, by removing the non-dom mechanism that got there, they've lost a lot of the high net worth taxpayers to Monaco and these really low tax paying jurisdictions. So again, you've got to be careful. You might chase your tax base away, and that's something that this country can ill afford. We've got a limited base of taxpayers that are paying the majority of the taxes. The other thing that they could possibly look at is a two-tiered VAT system. So, or multi-tiered, so you'd have your foodstuffs and basics at a lower rate, and you have a different rate for your luxury goods. The problem with that is it's not going to, if you bring it in, it's not going to bring any results immediately. It's going to take 18 months to 2 years to actually see the results. Systems are going to have to change. SARS are going to have to change the system, so that's quite a big one. So, as I said, it possibly could be a little bit boring from a tax perspective. But I think, at the end of the day, South African taxpayers are really taxed out. I think we're at a level where we're just paying a lot of tax. And the risk that the fiscus runs, increasing the taxes, will it bring in more tax? There is a possibility that it might not get that result at all.
South Africans are taxed out. I couldn't have put it better myself, Mike. I want to get your thoughts on something quickly before I let you go, and that is the revenue side of it. So if we're not going to get the revenues from tax increases or from new taxes being introduced, what are we likely to see from a government perspective that suggests that they could be increasing their revenue base?
Jimmy, I think it's about the economy. We've really got to get this economy started. We've got to get it going. I think we have got some positives. The government of national unity, that's giving us some stability. We've seen it maybe on an ad hoc basis where there's a little bit more activity in the M&A market. There seems to be a little bit more confidence in investment. Other thing is, the electricity, that seems to have stabilized. Okay, we had a hiccup for one day the other day, but I think that is sort of stabilized, and businesses can now see a little bit more certainty. And a lot of businesses have gone solar in any case, so the power isn't, to a certain extent, isn't a big issue for them. But I think really we've got to get this economy growing. It doesn't help that Trump is throwing his tantrums and, we've got the possibility of losing the AGOA benefits. But that's something that we'll have to work through. But I really think the only way we're going to get more taxes into the fiscus is possibly growing the economy, and then possibly looking at reducing wasteful expenditure and being critical about where we're spending our money and getting the infrastructure projects going. And you know, that will generate that multiplier effect of people spending more money, creating more taxes in the form of VAT and indirect taxes and income taxes as well.
It's time to look within. The budget speech is upon us. We will get that speech tomorrow, but for now we'll leave the conversation there. Thanks so much, Mike. Mike Toucher, partner for taxation at Forvis Mazars, joining us to share his thoughts and expectations ahead of tomorrow's budget speech.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Property Tuesday. We're taking a look at the property prices in Cape Town, or in the Western Cape in general. More specifically, the rental property market. It seems that market has seen quite a bit of a boom of late, and rental properties there are quite pricey. I'm joined on the line by the co-founder and CEO at Revo Property, Emmanuel Germanus, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of what's happening in the Western Cape. Good evening, Emmanuel. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did we get to this point? How did we get to the point where one bedroom in Cape Town rents out to 10,000 rand a month?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. So I think, you know, what's happened is that, you know, post the pandemic, there was a big suppression and depression on rental prices. And I think it's a matter of just actually catching up. So there's a big influx of people looking to live in Cape Town, both from locally and abroad. And I think these prices have actually caught up now.
Emmanuel, what's been some of the driving factors behind some of the location increases? I mean, I can imagine, even though we are seeing increases across the board in the Western Cape, some areas might be increasing at quicker rates than others, and some areas might be having more sustained increases. Do we kind of have an idea of what's causing that?
So I think, you know, every region has its certain attractions. Like the southern suburbs has a lot of schools in it, a lot of infrastructure like hospitals, etc. And I think people generally want to live closer to the schools if they're in the inner Cape Town area. The Winelands offers a very unique and different lifestyle. We're seeing a lot of people from Joburg move to the Winelands because it offers, you know, extensive grounds and offers a very different lifestyle to what they're used to. But still, that underpin of being in a security estate is very important to them. And that's what the Winelands offers. Winelands offers a lot of upmarket secure estates. So I think that's a big driver. On the Atlantic seaboard front, I think there's been a big commercial and retail boom post the pandemic. Lifestyle in the Atlantic seaboard has always been attractive with the coast being so close, access to the mountains, also in close proximity. But what's happened is that, you know, that retail and commercial components boom has, you know, enticed people to expand and explore more from a lifestyle perspective. It isn't just a region now for holiday makers. You know, there's a big sort of attractive lifestyle for sort of an owner and a tenant to live in the Atlantic seaboard.
Emmanuel, where are people getting all this money? I mean, I'm looking at what you're saying about the northern suburbs, southern suburbs, the Winelands. The prices aren't cheap, regardless of which area you're looking at. Are we seeing the same sort of demand on the properties that are being bought as well? Or is it kind of isolated to the rental side of it at the moment?
No, so I think what's happened is that there's been a very big influx, a larger than normal influx of foreign buyers. So people looking to not just coming on holiday, people that are looking to settle and live here permanently. So we've seen that big increase on the home purchaser side, which has put pressure on the local market. Prices have escalated across the board, across the Winelands, both locally in Cape Town, Atlantic seaboard, the southern suburbs. So prices are being elevated because there's not enough stock. There's foreign denominated currencies coming in, like the pound, euro, dollar, and these buyers have buying power, so it's pushing up the prices. I mean, that doesn't even consider the big immigration topic that we've been talking about for the last 36 months. People from Johannesburg and Durban and other provinces are also looking to establish here in Cape Town. And that's also put pressure on the prices, both from a rental and sale perspective. There just isn't enough property. That's just the reality of where we sit right now.
You touched on this immigration side of it, Emmanuel, and I wanted to get into the short-term versus long-term conversation to say, are we seeing more of the move towards signing in that long-term deal because I'm not able to have property readily available? When I do get something that I'm looking at or that I have been looking at, I'm happy to enter into a longer-term lease because I'd want to secure that property and I'd want to have that security. Is that something that's coming up from a rental perspective or even from a buying perspective?
So that's become quite a new thing now. What we're seeing is traditionally people always liked a sense of flexibility. Tenants were very reluctant to sign anything longer than 12 months. But the market we're in right now, we're getting 24 to 36 month lease contract signing requests from tenants, and I think it is giving a lot of comfort to landlords. But again, they're in the hot seat right now. They're in control, and they're saying, well, we don't know where the market's going to be at, 24 to 36 months from now. Is a normal escalation per annum fair, or do we just restrict people to signing, or tenants to signing 12-month leases because there might be an upswing greater than what inflation is? So 6-7% rental escalation, we're not really seeing a lot of landlords very keen on signing those contracts. They're saying to tenants, if you want to sign for 24 to 36 months, we need to see an 8-10% increase per annum on that lease.
I suppose this is where it's nice to always have those clauses that are renewable clauses, and those conversations with the landlord are easier to be had there. Emmanuel, what about the risk that we're running here of properties getting sort of so unaffordable that they start to create a bit of a problem? Or is the demand such at the moment that because there is so little supply, you're always, for the next couple of months at least, or next couple of years at least, you're always going to be able to meet the demand side of it, and so price escalations don't really price out anyone at the moment?
I think we're in a situation where the market's quite resilient, and I think we're not in any danger yet of sort of the local market being priced out. I think, relative to the rest of the globe, we're still very well priced. I mean, we've been awarded various accolades. Cape Town's been and the Western Cape's been awarded various accolades like best city in the world, best food destination in the world. And I think, when people arrive here and they understand what Cape Town has to offer, I think it's all relative. For the same sort of experience overseas, you're paying 10, 20 times the value. And I think locals, the more that they start to travel and realize, where the rand takes you and what you get for it, I think they, I wouldn't say happy to pay for it, but they feel a lot more confident paying for it.
Emmanuel, do you think that the current boom that we're seeing is giving rise to a lot more development? Are you seeing development start to come up to say, or property developers starting to say, we can now come in, put down a couple of units, there's a lot of commitments around it, there's a bit of a demand from that side of it, and that demand is being fueled by what's happening on the rental side?
So I think what's happened is that there's been a definite upswing in new developments going up across the board. And I think, it's twofolded. So the buy-to-let market's very big. And to your point, I think investors are getting in with the reassurances knowing that there's big rental demand. So the uptake of, let's call it, investment stock is increasing, which is allowing the developers to move on opportunities with the comfort that there's going to be uptake from investor buyers. I think there's still a very big shortage of family homes and properties where owner occupiers would live in, because again, I think, not everybody that's anticipated moving to Cape Town has been able to because there hasn't been enough property to do that. So people are waiting in the wings, both locally and abroad, for the next property to come up to allow them to make the move. So
Certainly some interesting insights around the property market in the Western Cape. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave the conversation there because we've run out of time. But thank you so much, Emmanuel, for those insights. Emmanuel Germanus, co-founder and CEO at Revo Property, on the property boom in the Western Cape at the moment. It's just gone 7 o'clock. As I said, we've run out of time. Greg Kos is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. But fear not, we'll be back for a double bill tomorrow as we dig into the budget speech. For now, good night.